Welcome to the first Afghanistan Research and Evaluation Unit podcast, a recording made in February 2010 as part of ARU's ongoing lecture series. The talk focuses on the policy-making process behind Afghanistan's Shiite personal status law. Based on a clause in the new Afghan constitution, the 2009 law was intended to apply Shia Islamic jurisprudence to the roughly 20% of Afghans who were members of the sect. But it proved controversial because some of the law's 249 articles contained restrictions on the rights of Shia women, and it was soon dubbed the rape law in the Western press. But the process through which the law was approved, drafted, and eventually ratified by the president was unclear at the time, and research was subsequently conducted for ARU on how the Shia law came to pass. That research was led by our speaker, Canadian Lauren Oates, who has been working on human rights, gender and education issues in Afghanistan since 1996. Lauren's paper for ARU, A Closer Look, The Policy and Lawmaking Process Behind the Shiite Personal Status Law, is available for download from www.areu.org.af.
Firstly, my thanks to ARU for organizing this lecture. It's neat to have an opportunity to speak directly about it, even though it's some months ago. And I was a bit nervous about this, actually, because it seems so long ago now that I had to kind of jog my memory back to the time where I was totally enmeshed in this issue for a couple of months. But it is an interesting time to be commenting on the personal status law, because it's practically disappeared from the media, from the international press right now. And the revised version of the law came into effect on July 27th of last year, of course, right before the presidential elections and the frenzy that followed those elections. And the revisions were not to the satisfaction of all parties and appear to be an attempt to appease different stakeholders in the context of the elections, as well as perhaps a hurried effort by the Ministry of Justice to get this out of the way. The new law contains articles carried over from the previous version that have been criticized by Afghan women's organizations and international groups like Human Rights Watch, though others still felt the revisions were an improvement over the first draft, like the Human Rights Commission. So as a brief reminder, the main contentious articles in the original draft were those that discriminated against women by restricting their freedom of mobility and requiring them to obey their husbands, the sexual obligations of wives to their husbands, the marriage age for girls, age 9 in the original draft, and the age of children when custody is granted from the mother to the father, among other issues. So there have been developments since the time we worked on the report and when it was first published. However, I'm going to restrict my comments to the period that I studied, which was until early June 2009, and within that period to the process behind the law rather than on its content, which is also the focus of the report, of course. There are some public analyses available on the content, if you're interested in that, including a report by No Peace Without Justice called Afghanistan's Shia Personal Status Law Analysis. And USAID has a publicly available English translation of the law that you can find on, I think, the UNHCR website, as well as other places. In the ARU report, there's also a chronology of key events in terms of the process. This was something that was always challenging to figure out what happened when was this actually drafted. So to the best of our ability, we tried to map that out. So there's a chart early on in the report if you want to refer to that for a more detailed level of events. But I'm going to focus more on the analysis of those events in the short time I have here. And there's much to say on this issue. I'll simply try to highlight what I see as really some key findings or aspects of the story that I think were not well known as the media frenzy was going on in full force. I was in Kabul in April when the law first started getting a lot of attention from the public and the media, and then the coverage from the international press that followed. And I was really struck by the immediate flurry of media interest, particularly from my own country, Canada. It was striking for two reasons from my perspective. Firstly, because few other previous gender-based legal and justice issues since 2001 had garnered anywhere near this much attention that the SPSL has. And examples that come to mind that might be similar but didn't get that kind of attention were the post-Taliban Department for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice, that was for a time discussed as a possible new government body. The requirement for women MPs to have a mahram or guardian, or since the SPSL, the signing of the new Elimination of Violence Against Women law. Secondly, it was striking for me because the story of women's legal rights in Afghanistan during the 5 years of the Taliban regime was never really front page news in the West. I've often heard women here comment that the destruction of the Buddhas in Bamiyan got more attention than what was effectively the destruction of women here. So in many ways, the international attention focused on this law was a sign of the times, indicative of the deep investment so many Western countries now have in Afghanistan and the relevance of what happens inside Afghanistan's parliament to audiences abroad. It's a sign that Afghanistan is no longer politically isolated and how integrated events here are with broader international efforts. So that was my introduction to this issue when my Afghan cell phone started ringing off the hook in April last year from journalists in Canada eager to report the story. But the content of the law, controversial as it is and was, is really only one part of the story. The part of the story that we went after at ARU was that of the process by which the Shia Personal Status Bill became a law. And what we found within this process were many insights into lawmaking in post-Ban Afghanistan and the political culture and capacity in lawmaking practices. The SPSL is illustrative of ongoing challenges to Afghanistan's democracy-building efforts, and it's further linked to multiple social development issues, which came up often in the interviews and which I'll touch on a little bit later. So looking at the process, the first significant finding is the pattern of deviations or irregularities from normal legislative steps in terms of technical procedure, or in other words, how the rules were quietly avoided. For instance, according to respondents, when the law came before the Walesi Jirga, Member of Parliament Abdul Razul Sayaft proposed passing it, quote, as a package, rather than reviewing it article by article as per the normal procedure. This proposal followed Sayaf's initial resistance to the law in whole until it was reviewed against Sunni law and the main contradictory articles removed. These articles included muta, or temporary marriage, and the right to marry two women from the same family, such as an aunt and a niece. Perhaps the most glaring omission in process was in February 2009, when a vote occurred in the Walesi Jirga over the law. There was significant confusion among members of parliament around whether the text of the bill itself was voted on, or whether a vote occurred only on a one-page proposal put forth by MP Sayaf that there would be no separate court system for Shias. It was later confirmed by APAP, the Afghan Parliamentary Assistance Project, legislative session summary from June 2009, that neither house actually voted on the law in whole or in part, but rather the lower house issued a statement that read as follows. On Saturday, 30th of January 2009, the lower house approved the law on personal affairs of Shias with the following. With the agreement of a committee of Sunni and Shia scholars on the omission of some issues and in accordance with Article 131 of the Constitution, the Supreme Court shall pave the way for implementation of the law on personal affairs of Shiites consisting of 249 articles. The implementation of the law does not require separate courts and judges. So in the Mishrano Jirga, this statement was not debated but approved by party leaders, apparently without the knowledge of other representatives, many of whom did not even learn about the bill at all until much later. One of our respondents called this deceitful, noting that the statement's wording, quote, was written to make it sound like the bill had passed when it had not. One MP stated, many people voted for it without knowing it was the last voting opportunity to do with the bill. It would seem that the statement's purpose was to serve as an advisory to the Supreme Court to begin applying the law's principles in the courts, despite Parliament having not actually voted on the law. and the lack of any precedent for using a short statement in place of an approved law. From there, the Supreme Court forwarded the law onto the president's office, where it was signed by President Karzai, apparently on the advice of one or more advisors. So it's evident that a number of people in Parliament elected to cooperate in sidestepping the normal procedures at the behest of the bill's original architects, or were too unengaged, or perhaps in some cases too intimidated to question the lack of due process. Other irregularities included that the Speaker of the House, Eunice Kanuni, the Parliament's General Secretary, and other MPs failed to flag deviations in process, such as the lack of a proper vote on the law, that the law was drafted outside of a government institution by individuals without relevant legal or legislation expertise. There was criticism over the absence of appropriate legal terminology, the structure and organization of the articles, and the contents incompatibility with the Constitution, international human rights law, and other sources of Shia fiqh, or jurisprudence. The failure to correct errors in process was likely further facilitated by the lack of a functioning bill tracking system in Parliament, which could have systematically caught anything askew from the normal procedure. At the time of the study, Parliament was using a single ledger for recording activity, recording on a CD the activity in Parliament and then later transcribing it. Documenting parliamentary activity is further confused by a system that is simultaneous as opposed to consecutive. Bills are amended by multiple committees at the same time, with no hierarchy of jurisdiction, making for a process that is difficult to monitor. Further, having specific rules that govern how each bill is considered would help prevent spoilers from bypassing or co-opting discussion and voting. For instance, bills of varying sizes by the number of articles would each necessitate different degrees of discussion prior to voting. These two weaknesses in practice make the system more vulnerable, particularly at a time where there is an uneven playing field in parliamentary politics between those who are backed by political networks from ethnic party factions and those who are independent. While the experience starkly illustrated critical weaknesses in the enforcement of procedure, respondents also largely agreed that this was a particularly deviant case. Several conditions colluded that made this law particularly vulnerable to various manipulations, such as its basis in Sharia law, its application to a minority seeking political recognition, and its gender aspects, and the personalities involved in its creation, among others. At the same time, these vulnerabilities are likely to resurface in other legislation that touches upon any one or a combination of these conditions. To sum up the issues of deviations in proper process, I'll quote one of the respondents who noted that, quote, "We have a parliament that's been elected, but every once in a while, we can drive a small camouflage truck through the back entrance into Parliament and then manage to get Karzai to sign it." So despite the evident sidestepping of proper procedure, another key finding was that there is in fact an evident buy-in and desire for the rule of law apparent across the spectrum of perspectives on the Shia law's content. And we saw this in the desire by all parties for the law to be legitimated through the Parliament, even if this required cutting corners. For example, it is notable that a mujahid and clerical figure like Mohseni used a legal channel by which to pursue his interpretation of Sharia-sanctioned practices for the Shia sect. Customary law continues to be a powerful force in the everyday lives of Afghans, and Mohseni might have found it easier and faster on a short-term basis to use this informal framework to impose his reading of the fiqh on personal status matters. It is significant that he sought to legitimate the law using formal state structures like the parliament. Yet, he relied on alternative support networks to pursue his desired outcome, such as utilizing his alliances and allegedly trading support. The continued use of these tactics, as well as the ongoing presence of power holders carried over from a very different kind of political era, where war-making superseded the basic obligations of a state towards its citizens, inevitably impacts on the kind of lawmaking that occurs. For almost all respondents to the study, lawmaking was a system for which they held a profound faith and perceived to be the primary means that their society could be changed. This is significant in a context where life has long been played out in a vacuum of rule of law, where politicians and citizens have used unofficial systems of governance and law enforcement in an environment where there has been little reliance on the state. Yet where there is weakness is in what some respondents perceived as the parliament's detachment from the public and the little hold there was among MPs of the idea of accountability to constituents, and indeed access to constituents. I go into this more in detail in the report with several examples. Another issue we saw within the parliamentary process behind the law is the ongoing impact of the legacies of Afghanistan's past conflicts and the resultant heightened role of ethnic politics, which continue to permeate the state's formal political institutions. Part of that legacy is in the continuing patronage networks and behind-the-scenes deal-making that fuel Afghan politics. And there's several examples given in the report, though most notably is the suspicion that Karzai struck a deal with Mohseni where his law would get through parliament and Mohseni would mobilize support for Karzai's candidacy in the August elections. Part of this legacy is also the dominance of identity politics over what Anna Woodsworth has called ideas politics. And the Shia personal status law found itself in an environment where identity politics eclipsed discussion over the substance of the bill. Just one example is how some MPs allegedly avoided discussions over the law, seeing it as either a Shia issue only, or were anxious over being perceived to undermine the Shia community's desire to have their own law. In a situation many Afghans perceive with urgency, where the huge problems facing the country demand commitment and care from those in office, a political culture that is organized more along ethnic lines than ideological partisan interests is all the more of a disservice to voters. So moving on to another key finding, we saw a really discrete diversification in Afghan politics of who endorses sources of interpretation of Sharia and sacred texts and the choice of appropriate schools of jurisprudence. In the case of the Shia law, women MPs, MPs without clerical backgrounds, and secular organizations like the Kateb Institute for Higher Education sought out alternative interpretations of religious scholars and challenged the ownership over lawmaking of the mullahs and clerical MPs. A small group of MPs partook in drawn-out negotiations with proponents of the law, who ultimately agreed to several modifications while rejecting numerous others. On issues that were left unchanged, according to women MP respondents, Shia male MPs engaged a discourse of the sanctity of their rights endowed by religion, which were unchangeable, such as the right to take a second wife. On some issues, those seeking reform managed to secure numerous conditions that curtailed some of the control the law gave husbands over wives, but could not have the article itself removed. When ideological confrontations erupt over laws that speak to religious values, the ownership over religious doctrine, and thus the political and cultural dominance of traditional power holders, is challenged. The appearance of others contesting the sanctity outside mujahideen and clerical circles makes the malleability of the fiqh more visible and challenges the power basis of the traditional political elite. The second half of the report is more or less a descriptive account of the roles and reactions of different stakeholder groups in the SPSL process, highlighting some of the frictions between those different interest groups and looking at how different players seek to contest and shape lawmaking in different ways. I'll just briefly mention each group and just one key finding for each in the interest of time, though there's more detailed analysis in the report. For the Shia community, respondents indicated that there was little awareness of the law before it went to parliament, and mobilization behind the law did not go far beyond Mohseni's own madrasa students. And ethnic politics within the Shia community provides some context here and are described in the report, with speculation that Mohseni, a non-Hazara Shia, is seeking influence among Hazara Shias through religious means where he lacks an ethnic connection. Within the Shia community, a group of Shia women organized the now infamous protest in April that was widely covered by the media here and abroad. And I thought it was noteworthy that the idea to hold a highly visible form of protest was provoked, in fact, according to the protest organizers, specifically by Mohseni's statements on his television station, Tamadun, that this law is based on the fiqh and no one has the right to challenge it. There can be no changes. The women were responding less to the content of the law than to the claim of ownership over the right to challenge religious writ and the attempt to speak on their behalf as members of the Shia sect. A protest organizer explained, quote, Mr. Mohseni had said, most women support this law. This was the main thing that motivated us. We didn't have any way to say, no, we don't support the law. That's why we wanted to do this. So again, we see this challenge to who has authority over religious interpretation. Another group I looked at is the Islamic clergy. The SPSL provided an opportunity for some Shia mullahs to assert their expertise and make a contribution to the state building process. They were essentially given official space to act, as one respondent called it. How they choose to share or not to share that space will do much to determine what kind of a relationship the clergy will have with a growing civil society that positions itself as grounded in values of international human rights and democratization, but that sees these values as compatible within an Islamic moral framework. The next group is civil society. There's a section devoted to civil society's role in the report, as their actions and rules in the SPSL process highlight several intriguing trends. One is civil society's increasing engagement with religious discourse and use of alternative Sharia interpretations to challenge jurisprudence and practice that violate human rights and women's rights. Another is recognition of their potential role in advocating for interest groups in the political arena with a parliament that has weak links with its own constituents. And a third trend is the active coordination that occurred over the SPSL process that signaled some growth and unity in the civil society sector. And next, there's the international community. The SPSL illustrated the tensions between the expectations of civil society from the international community and the international community's often slow response to human rights issues in Afghanistan. While the diplomatic community and international organizations may have perceived any outcry as further igniting anti-Western discourse from clerical figures and parliamentarians, in interviews, civil society representatives vocally accused the international community of passivity on this and on other human rights issues, in the examples they gave. Finally, we looked at the international and national media. Respondents' reactions to the international media coverage were mixed. One observer felt that the media had failed to adequately grasp Hazara perceptions of the law or to show an understanding of the dynamics within the Hazara community, such as the split between secularists and Islamists, and how this was being played out in the confrontations over the SPSL. There was resentment voiced over media articles that made blanket statements suggesting that the law was widely supported by the Shia community, and in particular, anger over the coverage of the counter-demonstration on April 15th that showed Afghan women demonstrating in support of the law. The Afghan national media gave very little, if any, coverage to the bill before it was signed by President Karzai, and many observers felt that the silence was unusual. Civil society and women MPs felt that the lack of coverage was on account of a national media that is unsympathetic to the objectives of the women's movement, and in some cases, even openly hostile to them. Mohseni's own media outlets covered the issue, though with the bias you might expect on his own TV and radio station. I think at this point I'd like to take some time to mention the recommendations of the report. I think that's probably the most important outcome of this exercise. And they're quite cross-cutting recommendations in that they hit a lot of sectors and they draw on recommendations that have come out of previous ARU reports. So the first is falls broadly under facilitating a peaceful pluralism in matters of jurisprudence, or fiqh. And the recommendation is the Religious Affairs Commission, or the Ministry of Hajj and Religious Affairs, should create formal opportunities for dialogue between members of the Sunni and Shia clergy and civil society organizations, and in particular with women's organizations. Such opportunities should be forums where constructive discussions might occur between the two groups and where each might offer the other specific roles, such as serving on advisory boards or facilitating community consultations. Such opportunities are needed to reduce hostility and build trust between the ulama and secular civil society. And that's something we really saw was this distrust as we talked to respondents from different sectors. Secondly, is the need to reform the party system in this country. Reinforcing earlier recommendations that are found in Anna Larson's work, the SPSL case also highlights that the government of Afghanistan must seriously reconsider the merits of the single non-transferable vote system, the SNTV, for parliamentary elections, and create the legal environment for a form of proportional representation or a party list system. Under the SNTV system, which is used in only three other countries in the world, candidates run as individuals rather than as party members, resulting in the marginalization of political parties, vulnerability to vote buying and manipulation, and a potentially unrepresentative parliament, among other problems. Removing the SNTV system and building a stronger party system would facilitate better representation of the public will in parliament, encourage political parties to develop platforms that appeal to the public interest, and help parliament hold government accountable. Thirdly is financing and supporting political parties. International donors should provide technical assistance and funding to strengthen democratic political parties and support them to develop platforms responsive to the electorate and to find means to engage on legislative issues that emerge. This recommendation also echoes earlier work from ARU, from Anna Larson's work, with similar findings, pointing to the really critical need for funding to new democratic parties. Fourthly, improving parliamentary procedure. The Ministry for Parliamentary Affairs should reevaluate its ledger system for recording discussion and voting in both houses and introduce a computerized instant transcription system. Transcripts and records of parliamentary decisions should be posted to the Parliament's website and made available to the media and public to facilitate public awareness and scrutiny of parliamentary discussion and voting. Fifthly, refining and enforcing parliamentary rules. The Ministry for Parliamentary Affairs should introduce specific rules that govern how bills of varying length are to be considered to help prevent discussion and voting being bypassed or co-opted, and should further modify parliamentary procedure to record how individual MPs vote. It's currently a card system and difficult to record how individual MPs are voting. This will facilitate greater accountability by making voting in the National Assembly more transparent to the electorate and to the media. Six, supporting the media's role in good lawmaking. Training opportunities should continue to be made available to all types of national media outlets that specifically target the media's role in democratization by sharing tools and techniques for journalists to question and scrutinize political figures and activities inside parliament and to play a monitoring role over parliamentary affairs. Training should include the need for sensitivity and awareness of how exclusion as a result of identity play out in lawmaking, considering the impact of laws on women and minorities and these groups' participation in lawmaking. Seven, growing links between MPs and civil society. The Women Parliamentarians Women Activists Network, which we mentioned in the report in a little bit more detail, should be explored as a model for other sectors or issues to instigate constructive communication channels between civil society and parliament. Similar networks could be formed for issues such as media, education, legal reform, minority rights, among others, as well as on the basis of constituencies. For example, NGOs and MPs working in the same province or representing common constituents. And finally, eight, encouraging accountability from lawmakers. International and donor organizations working on parliamentary development issues should explore how MPs' interactions with constituents can be better facilitated and should share concrete ways in which MPs can invite input from constituents on legislation and communicate issues of concern. So I'm going to end with the recommendations, hopefully in a forward-looking sense, and open it up for questions and discussion. And I should say that this report covered so many cross-cutting issues and so many different sectors, and I had to rely on the expertise of a lot of people to help me with the parliamentary process and rule of law and political parties and many other things. So Some of that expertise is in this room, so you know, please comment and add information and analysis that, that you have from the floor. So thanks very much.
The first question regards the implementation of the law. Has there been any follow-up as to whether there have been any victims of the law's controversial articles?
I mean, my role essentially ended in the summer, but that's something to watch for, certainly, is what's going to happen in the courts now. And I think it's still quite ambiguous how, you know, in which cases this gets implemented. If you have a Shia woman married to a Sunni man, what does she fall under? So it's something that I think needs to be closely monitored, but will be difficult to monitor as well.
Next comes a comment regarding the role of civil society, which the audience member feels was presented a little too positively in Lauren's report.
I think in terms of looking at civil society in an overly positive light, I think it's taking things in stride. There's obviously lots of capacity and unity and other issues affecting civil society here, or at least the groups that we were looking at, which was a subsector, women's organizations, legal reform organizations, and so on. And I think in this case, they were doing better than in the past. They actually came together across ethnic lines, across interest groups. The women who organized the protest were actually not from any organization, but were supported by the larger mainstream women's organizations. So you saw some maybe little changes here that were positive signs of better unity and trying to mobilize and some effectiveness in getting using the international media to their purposes. So it's not to say that they're amazing and they're the heroes of this, but that there were some improvements and some highlights as well as some challenges, which are mentioned in the report, like resentment. There were groups that were active from very, very early on and following this process when no one really cared. And they were joined by other groups later, once it was a popular issue to be working on, so that you saw some of that going on, some territorial issues and, credit issues and that kind of thing. But I think civil society learned some lessons from this whole experience as well. Good and bad.
The next question is a request for Lauren to evaluate the role of the international media during the controversy.
Well, I agree with a lot of the respondents that the media coverage was pretty simplified. They had a lot of drama to work with and didn't always go below the surface of that and weren't necessarily writing from a place of really knowing these issues, like the Shia community and some of that political context that is important for understanding what was happening there and the divisions within the Shia community, which is a story, really, but it didn't get uncovered. So it was a bit simplistic, and I know the women who organized the protest were very frustrated by all the nuances that were lost in the coverage of that protest. You had approximately 300 women who organized what they said they had wanted to be a peaceful vigil outside of Mohseni's complex, but turned violent when it turned out that there were counter-protesters coming. And from what I was able to unearth, the counter-protesters were recruited from inside his university in Madrasa. So there were a lot of men and some women students there. And that would be important to know. I mean, it's at his university, so he can quite easily generate a crowd. And there was a huge group of women trying to join the protesters who were blocked by Mohseni's camp. So even though there were 300 on site, there were others trying to join them. And what you saw in the media was, look, there were way more women who support the law than who oppose it, because I think there wasn't enough investigation of all of these other events that had happened just before and just after. A lot of good stories there that were missed out, like the attack on the Marifat High School that resulted after the protest. And actually, I think one or two people were killed in that attack on this school in Western Kabul. And I saw just one or two articles that covered that issue. And so I think, Yeah, it was a little bit simplistic, but it also, in terms of the broader issues, not just the protest, it helped keep the spotlight on this issue and the pressure on, and there may not have been reforms if this hadn't been taken up by the international press, because I think when civil society groups decided to turn to the media as a last resort, you know, it was a last resort. They felt that they were going to lose out if they didn't get this international pressure into play, and it ticked off President Karzai, but it did work, and they learned from that.
A follow-up question asks Lauren if she found any resentment among Afghan MPs that internationals were meddling in Islamic or sovereign affairs.
Yeah, among MPs, not so much women MPs, but among male MPs who were in support of the law, they saw that there, and Mohseni, of course, believed that this was meddling. I think, it was like pollution from the West. And one of the male MPs we interviewed felt that the West simply doesn't understand this law because, you know, they come from a Western legal tradition and we come from our Sharia legal tradition. And until they grasp that, they're never going to understand where we're coming from and why these things make sense for our society. And he was very adamant on that and had, you know, shown me letters that he'd written to various U.S. political figures trying to explain that they had totally misread the law. And sometimes they seemed to think that it was a wrong interpretation, and other times they said maybe they got a poor translation and substance was lost there. But yeah, they did see it as meddling from the West.
The next question also regards the role of civil society in campaigning for revisions of the law and points out that while it was difficult for them to act initially, civil society groups were eventually successful in having approximately 70 problematic articles changed. Lauren is asked to suggest ways for civil society groups to offer their input on laws that are being drafted.
Yeah, a few things. I think the issue of access was important here, where it was difficult for civil society to find out what was going on in Parliament. And in this case, they had an ally who was giving them information. And when they found out how close this was to actually being signed, they started mobilizing and they managed to get a delay in the voting in the Parliament. So it was supposed to be voted on in, I think, February 2008, and it was delayed for about a year. And so that gave a year of time to the groups to mobilize around this and to get caught up. And they were able to do that because they had a link to an MP. And so I think that's why that recommendation talks about links between civil society and MPs. And sometimes it will happen organically. You know, if you have people in Parliament who are already linked to civil society sectors, but sometimes it needs a more formal mechanism to facilitate that access. And then also going back to the recommendation about transparency about what's happening in the Parliament, it can be hard to find out where a bill is, what stage is it in. And, so some of those technical improvements that could make it a little bit easier to find out who voted on what was the discussion, what is the parliamentary agenda, what's coming down the pipeline. Those information and communication issues are important. And building links between, formal links between MPs and civil society groups.
The final comment goes back to the issue of international involvement. The audience member says that because foreigners come from a very different tradition and know little of Sharia, some consider it inappropriate for them to be involved in drafting legislation, and says that the international community must consider the best role for themselves, because pushing certain laws that are not appropriate for Afghanistan could prove counterproductive.
Yeah, I think it can be alleviated in part, though, by stronger links between MPs and their constituents, so that it's less about what the foreigners want, or the warlords, or the MPs, but about what their constituents want. And that came up often, people not knowing how to reach their MP, that it's not an open door policy, it's really difficult to have access to them, and people aren't getting news about legislation that's going to be coming so that they can comment on it and learn more about it or express their needs. So that's, I think, a major, major issue, is evolving the idea of being accountable to a constituency as an elected member of parliament.
Thanks for listening to the inaugural ARU podcast. And for information on new podcasts and to download ARU papers, please see our website at www.areu.org.af.